baby.
Welcome to the Real Wolf Record Club. I am your host, Joe, and with me, as always, is Ben from the Real Wolf Record Club panel here again, talking with you about some of the great, great records. And I'm a little excited today because we've got a whole new, Ben, is it genre or genre? One is definitely
genre.
You're going with genre.
Genre.
It's definitely more English major, but a new genre for you. I'll go Minnesota. Breaking some new ground. We've covered rock, folk, rap, soul, live records, dad rock, prog rock, R&B, jazz, alternative. This is a new one. We are cracking the seal on our first electronica album. And I know when you hear what album, you're going to tell me it's not electronica, but let's start with the roots. It's our first electronica album. And Ben, I know your ears perked up, and certainly our guests probably did, because DJs are like, they're like the goalies, the pitchers, the kickers of music, right? They're always there. You need them, but they're just a little off, right? Is that fair? Is that fair, Ben?
That's fair. That's very fair.
I mean, but when this came up, Ben, were you a little excited for this one, I think?
Yeah. Yeah, Moby's it's a good album. I like this one.
I don't have a ton of experience with electronica or electronic music. And every time people talk about Prodigy, they always tell me it's either Prodigy or The Prodigy. And then I think of that song, had crabs on the front of the album. You see how unversed into electronica I am? That's why I'm so excited to get in this, because this is a big one. Ben already gave it to us. It's the fifth studio album by Moby, an accomplished composer, DJ, songwriter, and is consistently ranked among the best albums of all time. It was nominated for a Grammy, but it's more widely regarded, not for the awards it won, but that it was an electronic album that became a full-on pop sensation. And if nothing else, if absolutely nothing else, you hear the first three tracks of this song, they're so immediately recognizable that you will be instantly transported back to 1999 as soon as the sample hits your ear. We are, of course, talking about the one, the only, Play by Moby. Joining us on the show is a recovering former DJ himself, working as both DJ and music director for Airwaves Across the Midwest, who I'm told by a good friend of ours that he will judge you completely and exclusively by your favorite band. Ooh. Along with his wife and daughter, his family, he runs and hosts the show, the Brooker Family Popcast, a weekly pop culture show covering pop culture, music, entertainment, and all things fun. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Brooker is our guest here on the Real Wolf Record Club. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I do have to say, I mean, I'll give it to both you guys. I have a little bit of a confession that, obviously sounding super nerdy about electronic, it wasn't that long ago that if you guys told me Matt Moby and Fatboy Slim were the same person, I could have been convinced. That's how I know Moby. I know who he is.
Yeah.
Fatboy Slim. But I mean, this is a record that's important to you. What's your guys' experience with this record, being that I'm outnumbered by DJs?
Well, first of all, I love the fact that you use the term electronica as opposed to techno, because I think techno conjures up some images of like glow sticks and bubble parties and warehouses at 4 a.m. and stuff like that. And there is that element to it, but electronica is just a more widely, it's got a wider coverage. You know, electronica, for sure. Right. I've been told the definition between electronica and techno, electronica is defined as techno music that you don't have to dance to. You can just sit and listen to it like you would any other album. Whereas techno is more dance floor stuff. Techno is dance music. Electronica is the same, but you can also just put it on and listen to it in the background while you're driving or something like that. And this album is a perfect example of that, in my opinion.
So
it's Moby versus Sandstorm, right?
Yeah.
It's electronica versus techno.
Yeah, but basically, Sandstorm. Yeah.
Ben is dancing.
I'm dancing. Yes, for those
Electronica. Electronica is so broadly covered. You can type up genres of electronica in Wikipedia right now, and there's like 200 or 300 different genres and subgenres of electronica. Everything from drum and bass to ambient to techno to house. There's even like a Nintendo core techno, which is crazy and weird. Yeah. But it's all there, and it's just it depends on what genres and subgenres you like.
I was in Hungary, actually, Budapest. And somebody kept saying, hey, tonight, this was probably around the time this was really getting big, but somebody kept saying, hey, we should go to a drum and bass show tonight. And he was German.
Yeah.
Drum and bass. Drum and bass. Say that enough times. And I'm hearing this German dude wants to take us to a German bass party. That sounds awesome. And I got there, and it was very different than what I expected. So that's how
what did you expect from a German bass party? That could go
a lot of ways, but it was not what I thought it was. It was under an overpass in Budapest, and it was amazing. Anyways, that's for another show. But I mean, you know, you guys both seem to have some experience with this record. I mean, when I listened through it, there is an ambience in the sense that maybe not ambience, ubiquitousness. It was everywhere. This album was everywhere. I mean, car commercials and remixes. I mean, how did you guys fall in love with this record?
Well, I've kind of always liked Moby from my DJ days and everything else. I liked his first big single, Go. It was a big dance floor hit, huge. So he was on the scene for me then. And then he came out with an album called Animal Rights, which was his like punk rock album that he tried to do.
Guitars
and punk rock covers and stuff like that. And his cover of Mission of Burma's That's When I Reach for My Revolver is outstanding. I still to this day love that song. But this album hit in 99, and surprisingly, and here's the reason why it's so familiar to everybody. This album came out in 99, didn't sell. Wasn't doing any good, didn't sell any albums. Critically, it just kind of wasn't there. So what Moby and his marketing team did is they licensed it. They licensed the whole album for commercials, trailers, movies, TV shows. So 99, 2000, think back to any TV show trailer or preview or promo that you saw, you heard those opening strings of Porcelain, or you heard, you know, some of those ambient sound beds came off of this album. That's why it became so familiar. And that's when the sales just started taking off.
Just seeped into the brain of everyone. Just the pop subconsciously.
Zeitgeist. It just everyone absorbed it.
It's like for the Star Trek fans out there, you've been fully assimilated into the Borg.
Resistance is futile for this album in the populace, I tell you.
Oh man, we try to get as many Star Trek references on the show as possible.
We're getting deep track nerd here. This is great.
They mentioned it on the show with Moby. I'm in. There's definitely a lot to unpack in it. We've talked about several records that have that Borg assimilation effect, I guess it would be called. But where it gets you kind of mentioned it, Chris, you can let it play and play and play. And that's what its appeal is. And that's kind of one of the measures that I actually judge a great album is what's its playability. How long can you let it go? And before you're like, oh, it's turning over again.
Yep.
If you don't ever notice, and that some people mean that sounds kind of a little bit flat, but it's just so consistent. And that's kind of what this album has, I think. But we'll see. We've got a lot to unpack with it. We want to first turn to our guest, Chris Brooker, here on the Real Wolf Record Club, and ask him all kinds of questions about him. So, Chris, let's talk about this. Let's start, because music director, DJ, tell me, I'm picturing radio airwaves on like I-80 in Nebraska, and you turn
pretty
it
close.
On. Like, pretty close. Where did you get your start in music? I mean, that's so cool, but like, you've got a voice for radio and you've done it for a long time. Tell me about it.
Actually, that's kind of how I got my start, is people kept saying, you've got a great voice. You should, I was in journalism at the time. I got my degree in journalism, but people said, you know, my wife's got a face for TV. I've got a face for radio. So I went the radio route, and I knew someone who knew someone. I got in at a local station in my hometown, my college town, and I became music director of that station very fast, program director eventually. Then I moved to a bigger city where I worked kind of part-time overnight shifts, you know, the radio gig. You know, you work your overnights, you work your part-time shifts, you're filling shifts. And eventually I got to program a station up in Topeka, Kansas. I did it for about 10 years in the 90s. And that was just a great decade to yeah. be in radio, you know? Right. And I was working in alternative radio at the time when alternative was just redefining kind of how radio sounded and everything else like that. So it was very exciting, very, and I'm, you know, so proud of, you know, the work I was able to do at that time.
What was so exciting about the 90s? Man, we could tell you, I mean, we're from the era, we cut our teeth musically, you know,
same
at that, but how, what was so special about it at that time?
Well, for me, you know, the 90s came around, of course, you had the big music revolution, you know, hair bands were going out. The alternative scene came in, grunge, whatever you want to call it. And you had these stations that didn't know how to pinpoint a sound. So you had everything from, you know, your Pearl Jams, your Nirvanas, your Soundgardens, Stone Temple Pilots, things like that, to the Gin Blossoms, to Liz Phair, to people were trying everything. And at one point in time, I want to say 93, 94, radio was so incredibly interesting to listen to. And then it started to homogenize near the end of the decade. People started pulling back. You started not hearing the female artists as much anymore. And you started hearing more heavy rotation on the Pearl Jams and the Nirvanas and things like that. And then Korn and Limp Bizkit. And, you know, that kind of started taking it out for me. But music was very interesting because of the diversity and the chances that a lot of records or radio stations were trying to make.
So you're doing radio music director. I mean, are you getting to select some of those things that are interesting that maybe, you know, somebody at meat and potatoes of this is what's popular, this is what's charting. Is there something you get to do at some point where you're like, I'm going to play this record?
I was very lucky in the first station I worked at. It was a commercial station in my hometown of Stillwater, Oklahoma, a small commercial station, but we were in a college town. And so all the indie record labels loved us. We could call them up and get anything we wanted. And they would send us, we got great service. I had stacks of CDs, you know, 200-300 CDs high in my office to listen to. And because we were an independent station like that, we weren't owned by a chain or anything else like that. We got to play whatever we want. I would come on some nights and just freeform it. And my love of electronica came from that because I was music director. I was going to school at the time, but I was also working the late shift, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. And by midnight, I was toast some nights. I just couldn't, I couldn't put a sentence together. So I was looking for long songs to play. And I knew we had this great catalog, this back catalog of electronic music that never got played. So I started throwing on the random song. You know, The Prodigy, Chemical Brothers, Moby, every now and again, Future Sound of London, Morcheeba, stuff like that. And people started responding to it. So I put a show together for a couple of years. I had a show called The Red Eye, which went from midnight to two at my station, and it was all electronica. And that's how I really kind of got into electronic music, was out of boredom. Out of boredom and my general laziness. I wanted to sit back and relax for 6 or 7 minutes instead of 3 or 4 minutes. And so I was trying to find long form songs, and they fit the bill, and I ended up kind of falling in love with them.
Is there there was a alternative station here in the Twin Cities called Rev 105, and when they were going out of business, they played It's the End of the World as We Know It by REM. I think 24 hours straight at one. There was another station that did, they played
That's been done.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been done, but I mean, no, that's kind of the classic. What was the most subversive thing or crazy thing that you plugged into the ears of the people in Stillwater, Topeka, where you were?
Oh, like my
what was your
my last night on the air for my first station at Stillwater? I went completely freeform. I brought in my own crates from home, and I was playing like Public Enemy. I threw on some Anthrax. I was just going all over the place.
Gone nuts.
It was, but you know, on those freeform nights when I would occasionally do it, I would get the random phone call saying, "Hey, that last hour of music you just played was better than anything I've ever heard before from your station," and it was totally came from up here. And that's just a fantastic, you know, boost in confidence right there.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I'm curious. I mean, how does that parlay into, I mean, radio is the new podcast or the new radio, and you make that leap, from radio. It's odd. It's more scripted. Obviously there's more things you have to look for and deal with, but How do you make the leap? How did you make the leap and figure out a way to incorporate, you know, you're like the talent family, like you put them all on the show together. And like, how did you say, you know what, we can do this? I mean, were there things that you, I mean, Heather's very talented, but also you're looking at your daughter and you're like, I think she has a place on the show too. Like, how does
she's
that
got things
together?
To say? Yeah.
Right. Right.
The Brooker Family Podcast is, you know, stems from those conversations we've had as a family. And some of the best conversations we've had have been, you know, on the way home from a movie that we've all loved, whether it's like a Marvel movie or DC movie or any movie we either loved or hated. And we have these discussions in the car on the way home. You know, we talk about what we liked. And my daughter's got this unique perspective on, you know, things she likes and things she appreciates. She's a huge Marvel fan too, for 10 years old. And we, you know, my wife kept saying, you know, this would be a great podcast. This would be something that's really cool. And so, yeah, we put it together and we sit around for, you know, half hour, 40 minutes, whatever. And we talk about, you know, movies we're excited about, movies we didn't like sometimes. We have the privilege to see some advanced screenings. So we can give people like a sneak peek on things. I get to talk about music a little bit and recommend, you know, various albums and songs that I like. And so it's like a natural progression of our family dynamic in the podcast space.
Sure. Is there, you know, you mentioned music, obviously, you know, Heather's a very talented actor and, you know, Channing is a young person. I'm always curious about the dad element. Is it like, oh, dad's rock? Like when I get in the car, I have a daughter and she's very tolerant and she likes a lot of adult music.
Oh yeah.
But there's stuff that I try to put on and she's like, change this one, dad. Come on, man. It's just one song.
As a parent and as a parent who's so musically inclined, I feel that's been one of my biggest failings. Ever since she was a kid, I've been trying to get her to listen to my music. I was like, oh, you got to listen to this, you know, you got to listen to this Portishead track. It's so good. You know, it's fantastic. And she's like, no, you know, she likes Imagine Dragons. She likes 21 Pilots. Billie Eilish is cool to her. Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift, of course. And I can't fault her for that. You know, I'm not a huge Imagine Dragons fan, but I've got to admit, they have good pop songs and they've got a really good message. And so I can't fault her. At least she's starting to like music now. So I'm like taking every nugget that I can. And if I can be somewhat of an influence there, perfect.
Yeah. That was Ben. I mean, you remember that was Ben is a little bit further on the parent path than me. And I remember sitting there in his basement at a party playing music and his daughter, I forget. It was, I always forget
dog
what
days.
The dog
dog
yeah.
days. Dog here's Florence of the Machine.
Oh, Florence of the Machine. Awesome.
And I remember thinking, I'm like, there are cool little kids. Like, there are cool little kids out there. They're not
they
all.
They do, like Porta said, they like Glory Box. They always ask me.
Oh, that's a great song. That's fantastic.
Because my sister's name is Gloria. So they're like, play Gloria Box. Okay.
You got hip kids. You got hip kids. That's fantastic. Hey,
yeah. And it's really weird. And for us is, you know, a lot of driving during the pandemic and things like that where, and so it was a lot of music and she did, our daughter did go through the, let's listen to Elmo stuff. And I got to tell you, there's some killer Sesame Street tracks. Monster in the Mirror is a banger.
Kids Bop rocks.
Yeah, for sure. But she's got this visual thing where we'll have music videos on. Yes, they still exist. And we put on like a Kurt Vile video once and she just zapped into her brain. And so she wants that one on in the car. And I'm like, oh, I get it. Yeah. So she's into she's into the Harry Styles and the Taylor Swift too. And that, you're right. Pop is pop music. It's catchy for a reason. And so I'm with you. It's funny how it soaks through though. It hits your kid and then translates something completely unexpected.
You know, I've developed somewhat of an appreciation of pop. My last radio gig, I programmed a pop radio station in Kansas. It was a top 40 station. And I went in not loving that genre of music at all, not loving that particular format, but I grew to appreciate it because people love pop music. People love the top 40. And, you know, I lost some of my music snobbery, you know, during that gig. And now I can appreciate, you know, a good pop song every now and again.
Yeah. So what is the plan for the show? It's fairly new, right? It started this year, 2020.
We're on our second season right now. So we just started our second season a couple of weeks ago.
Gotcha. And the plan, I mean, a lot of it covers, is it mostly, and I'm thinking for the listeners who are saying Brooker Family Podcast, let me check this out. What's your sweet spot? Like, what's the thing that you love to cover? Because obviously it is it's a reflection of kind of a loving little triangle you've got going in your family.
Yep.
But what's the sweet spot? What's the show that you're like, I'm so excited to do this. I love doing this.
I love when we talk about, you know, an experience that we've shared together. Like we'll see a screening of a movie, like we saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the new Spider-Man movie. Mm-hmm. We all loved it. And I couldn't wait to get in and talk about it, you know, with the three of us and just kind of share our joy for this movie that we just really loved so much. And, you know, Channing was talking about it. Heather was talking about it. I had things to say about it. And we all have different perspectives of what we saw. And it just makes it fun. You know, I like just going in there and having fun. It's not about, you know, who's listening. It's just, I like talking to my family about, you know, music and movies and TV and stuff like that. So.
And that's what I love that too, because you can definitely feel that on the show when you listen to an episode. And listeners, please check out Chris smiled when I said this, because I keep calling it podcast. It is a podcast, but it's called the Popcast. And so make sure you type that in, but check it out, because you can definitely feel that vibe. It's a weird, weird time. It's a weird, weird world right now. But having people on the air who love being with each other and love talking about things that they enjoyed together, I mean, that comes through your ears. It's awesome. It's really good. And that's kind of the vibe and lane that, you know, Ben and I have here. We obviously, my spouse Hannah comes on the show sometimes, and we've had friends on the show, and we're here talking about the things that drive us and the things that make this world passable. God, that got dark heavy. That's really the goal here, is talking about music that connects all of us. But definitely check out, where can people check out the Brooker Family Popcast?
So you can get it anywhere you get your podcasts, you know, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, stuff like that. We're also video. You can watch us on Apple TV. I think Spotify even has a video player as well. You know, we actually are in studio filming us and filming our interactions too. So you can watch the podcast as well as listen to it.
Ben and I were talking about that. We're like, do you think we could be a video podcast?
Sure, sure.
I think you could do anything these days, but I love that. Definitely
video
check out.
Video podcasts are growing for sure.
I know. And there's definitely a vein, but I'd have to clean myself up a little bit, but definitely check out the Brooker Family Popcast. I think if you look them up on Google, the Google machine as well, you'll find them, but check them out. A lot definitely. Of good stuff on there. I think it is time for our favorite part of the Real Wolf Record Club, which is Ched Talk. Chris Brooker, are you ready for Ched
Talk? I'm ready.
Talk?
Hit me.
All right. First question here on Ched Talk. You kind of hit on this before. You're a music guy with strong music opinions, a lot of tastes, but you're also a little bit older and not like ancient.
Ouch.
Old like me. Old
Ouch.
Like me. Old like me.
Oh, old like you. Okay.
Old like me. Which, if you're like me, you're like Ben, you're like Patton Oswalt, you'll find that as you've gotten older, you don't hate much music anymore.
Yes.
What's a band that you find you no longer hate?
So in my music heyday, I was so snobby about music. It was all indie all the time for me. Yes. If you were a mainstream band, you sucked.
Right.
And the band I railed against the most in the 90s, I think, was probably Bush. And now I find myself, maybe it's nostalgia, you know, for that time coming back, I'll hear the song and I don't turn it off anymore. I'll actually, sometimes I'll turn it up a little bit. The Bush, Gin Blossoms, I found a new appreciation for, and I couldn't stand them when I worked radio.
That's two Gin Blossom references. We have to pull that one out. I mean, you could put on their four big singles and switch out the verses and the choruses on any song, right?
Yep.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, totally. It's a Lego of music.
It is. That's a good way to put it. So, I mean, Bush is, that's the one, or is there, I mean, is that kind of what you found, is if it was mainstream then? Because for me, it was the Rolling Stones for sure. As a kid, I was like, I was into indie rock, hardcore punk, hip hop, things like that. And I was like, ugh, grandpa music. And now that I've gotten older, I'm into the blues and I'm less like, I get it. It's clicked. I get it.
Yeah.
And they're the ultimate pop band, ultimately. I mean, at the end of their pop songs are really poppy, but, yeah. So,
well, any pop band actually from that era, you know, like TLC's Waterfalls, You know, I hated that side of the musical spectrum in the 90s yeah. so much, because I was rock, I was alternative, you know, and this was, you know, more of an R&B hip hop vibe. And now I go back and I listen, I was like, man, that's actually a really great song. That's, you know, from a song perspective, that's a solid
yeah.
song.
Yeah. Actually, you mentioned TLC. If you're looking for other ways to spend your time than talking about Marvel movies with your fans, or with your family in the car, I came up with a great road trip game, and which is listing off people who have died. And we got in the debate, a group of friends, we got in the debate about which person from TLC. And then somebody said Salt and Pepper. I'd like,
it's Left Eye. It's Left Eye, isn't it?
Left Eye.
Yeah. I thought it was Left Eye.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it's Left Eye.
Well, didn't Spinderella from Salt and Pepper, isn't she the one that passed? Maybe.
Listeners, do you see what's happening here? It seems morbid and dark, but if you say name people who have died, you could say, "Oh, my grandpa died. God bless him." You know, you could go that route, but you could also be like, "I'm pretty sure that guy from Third Rock from the Sun." No, not him. He's dead. No, you could go through, and then suddenly you're off on a tangent. So I'm going to trademark that. That's a good one. Ben is next up here on a Ched Talk with Chris Brooker.
Chris, you have a segment on your Brooker Family Popcast called yep. Brooker Beats, where you talk about what's happening in the music scene. What musical artist would you most like to drop a beat live on the show? A Brooker beat, if you will.
Ooh, drop a Brooker beat live. You know what? This is weirdly timely for this episode that I'm with you guys that I'm doing, but Moby. I just recently, in one of the last episodes, he just dropped a new album called Resound NYC. It's kind of a remix album and stuff like that. But I would love to have him come in, and he's a musician too, so he could just come in yeah. and play guitar, and you know, or whatever. It's I would love to have that, and he's LA local, so he could totally do it with us.
So if you're listening, Moby or Fatboy Slim, whoever you are, Brooker Family Popcast is looking to get your agent's number. Excellent.
Speaking of 90s electronica.
Wow. On your show, you hosted the cast of the Rugrats reboot on Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
What was Angelica's deal?
What do you mean?
I mean, just is that she was a toddler? Did she have behavior issues? I mean, what happened to her?
She was a controlling toddler is what she was, I think. Who didn't like mingling with the babies.
Ah, God. Well, I like that because Hannah, my better half, she can rap Nicktoons with the best of them. And she wanted me to ask, but I said no because it was kind of a yes or no question. She said, did Grandpa survive?
Oh,
like, did they kill off Grandpa in the reboot? I'm like, I don't think they killed off Grandpa.
I honestly don't know. I'm gonna have to research that.
Did he die?
There it is. Did Grandpa? Is he dead? There it is. Because I mean, you really think about that. That would be a dark turn from a show that millennials everywhere.
I watched it when it was originally there. Yeah.
And you're like, wait, he died? Oh no! Like,
not Grandpa.
Trouble. Not Grandpa.
Grandpa Pickles?
All right.
What?
Grandpa Pickles. R.I.P. All right. Next question here on Ched Talk. Troll time. It's troll time. You're going to be trolled with this question. Nirvana's Bleach is okay. not the best sub pop record of all time. Why?
Ooh. Because, is it though? Is it not?
There's a lot of people who say it's the best. And my working theory is that there's a lot of lazy hipsters out there. There's a lot of lazy music fans, because you can go on Spotify and you can see plays and you can see this and you can see that.
Yeah.
I mean, you got it. Postal Service. Give Up is a sub pop record. And that's
a solid album.
It surpasses. It's gone so much further than I mean, I'm not saying that is, but.
Well,
Nirvana Bleach.
Well, you think about the timing of it, though. I mean, you know, Nirvana Bleach came out, you know, 30 plus years ago.
89, right?
Something yeah. like, yeah. Yeah, 30 plus years ago. And Postal Service, is Postal Service going on 20 now for that
that's
song?
Gotta for be, the, that's got to be 2002 album? Or 3. It was college for yeah. me. So
it was right about 2002, I think.
Yeah, 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 about 20 years. And, you know, they're touring again, actually. So that's great.
Yeah, it's a 20-year anniversary tour. That's right. It's 20
yeah,
years.
Yeah, yeah, they're playing here in LA, yeah, I think in October. But you know, that's a tough call. I can't
Let's flip it.
Genres too. It's two completely different genres. You know?
You're a big Sub Pop guy. You talked about some of the records, and I say that because on your website you have a Sub Pop shirt on. I'm like, oh, I'm going for it.
You're calling me out. You're calling me out.
I'm a Sub Pop. There's a lot of great stuff that's come off that label. So what is your favorite Sub Pop record if you had to pick one?
You know, I'd have to go back into the archives here, because I'm totally drawing a blank. I will say Nirvana is probably the one that stands out the most as being the most one of the most popular. Mm-hmm. I completely forgot about Postal Service. Honest with you,
Pitchfork. Everyone hates on Pitchfork, but I will tell you they do a great job of canvassing music and pulling.
Why do people hate Pitchfork? I like Pitchfork.
I like it because of the camp, but sometimes you read it and I'm like, oh, if I were your editor, I would tell you, you should pull out some of the, just tell me what you're trying to say. You don't have to say everything's, not everything's derivative. Not everything's this, not, you know, just speak in plain language.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that, but they pull out lots of great stuff, and they had a 20 year Sub Pop anniversary, and they were talking about the Afghan Whigs, and they were talking about all these different
Afghan Whigs.
Right. And so
they weren't on Sub Pop the whole time, though, were they? Because I think they moved over to Capitol.
Yeah, and they just pulled out one record that was from that label release. And I saw, you know, a lot of that. So I started thinking, I'm like, everyone gives Nirvana due credit, but Bleach Nirvana came after, in the sense of people appreciated it after their big smash, right?
Yes, yes.
So I mean, that's kind of, I think people are like, well, that has to be. It's their first one. It has to be, right?
Yep.
Maybe.
Yep.
Maybe.
Well, I had that same reaction with Liz Phair. I discovered Liz Phair when Whipsmart came out, and then I went back and listened to Exile and Guyville. I was like, oh, this is okay. This is where it's coming from. This is the cred. I see that. Yeah.
She is, by the way, on tour.
Yes, this fall, she is. Yes.
Playing Exile and Guyville start to finish. And
it's like, yeah, it's the anniversary tour.
Anniversary tour. We bought tickets. We're going to go see Exile and Guyville. And see if it is, in fact, a response to Exile on Main Street. Because
I saw her open up for the Flaming Lips years and years ago, and it was such a good show. So good.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see. All right, so moving on. Final question here on Ched Talk, leading into our discussion of Moby. This one I'm afraid to throw out there because it's kind of heavy, and I don't know where it'll go. But did Moby kill rock?
No, I don't think he did. I think he almost killed electronica at one point when he came out with Animal Rights, but I don't think he killed rock by any means. I think he maybe to some degree, maybe, well, I don't want to say he helped it, but I definitely think he added to the blend. Sure.
I think we have to unpack this for sure. I think he wins here on Ched Talk. Ben, Chris, another victory.
Pull marks. Right.
Hey, perfect.
Victory.
We're going to take a quick break here on the Real Wolf Record Club, come back and discuss Moby Play with Chris Brooker. This is the Real Wolf Record Club.
Hey, this is Chris Brooker with the Brooker Family Podcast. You are now listening to the Real Wolf Record Club.
Yeah, so the did Moby kill rock? I think I'm going to lead it. I'm not saying he did it intentionally, like I'm going to kill it, but like I just, in my mind, I think.
Yeah, you'll have to explain that statement just a little bit.
Well, because I go back and I think, all right, so we've got, you know, a lot of people say this is the crossover record for him and for electronica, that it's shot into pop sensation. And by doing so, it maybe coincidentally right at the turn, you know, 99, 2000, 2001, where there were fewer and fewer bands, and you kind of hit on it. You got Limp Bizkit, you got Korn. I mean, those are your rock bands that are popular.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam was kind of self-imposed exile with some of their, you know, more offbeat albums.
Well, they went the touring route too.
Yeah, exactly. And so the timing of it syncs up with, if you were to posit that his explosion onto the scene helped propel electronic music, sampling everything and, you know, smashing and destroying of guitars and drums.
Yeah.
There's an argument. So that's where I was going with that. So we'll see what Ben has to say about that. All right, we'll come back here in 5, 4, 3, 2. Welcome back to the Real Wolf Record Club. We are here talking about Moby Play with our good friend Chris Brooker from the Brooker Family Popcast. I asked Chris during Ched Talk a question. It was less controversial than I thought, but I couldn't help. This album, Moby Play, is regarded as kind of the album that helped mainstream listeners of mainstream music, how about that, believe that electronic music could be, in fact, chart-topping music. It was popular. It could sell well. It could tour well.
And here in the States, especially.
Especially here in the States, because overseas, as we've heard, German bass parties are huge. But it's helped really kind of propel that. And at the time, you look, and when did this album come out? 99, 2000, 2001 is when it really got big. You have... what, Korn, Limp Bizkit, there's a lot of, as I'd call it, sludge metal kind of
watered down grunge.
Yeah, not
new
green.
New metal.
Ooh, that's the worst. That's the worst.
You had new things metal. Called the Family Values Tour, where I can say this because it's an audio only podcast, but raise your hand if you've been to more than one of those. Chris is laughing because that's me. But I don't know. And I don't mean it as a slur or a slant or a slight against Moby that he did it, but is that what happened? I mean, is that where we're at in music? Is rock dead?
I think it's so interesting because I've mentioned the album Animal Rights before. Moby put that album out right when there were other electronic bands breaking in America. Fatboy Slim, for example, Fatboy Slim, The Prodigy, Chemical Brothers, stuff like that. They were breaking and they had some hit singles in America. So America was already discovering techno to a degree, electronica to a degree. Unfortunately, he came out with Animal Rights, which further, like, who is Moby? What is he even trying to accomplish with this album? And so Play was actually supposed to be his last album. He was planned on, you know, wrapping things up after this album, quitting music altogether, because he figured he had failed. You know, just miserably. And so, yeah, then Play came out and it started hitting. But at that time, music was also changing. You know, music goes through those cycles and things like that. You know, the grunge years, the alternative years of the 90s, the heyday of 94, 95, 96, the new metal started coming in. The watered down grunge started coming in. You stopped hearing female artists on the air anymore. And, you know, music as it does just started to change. So I don't think Moby killed rock necessarily. I think rock just evolved or devolved, you know, whichever way you want to look at it. Rock just started to change. And whether that's a fault of the record labels or a fault of the listeners or a fault of the musicians, who knows? It's up for debate. But I think music itself just started to change at that point in time.
Yeah. And in this album, I mean, it's not, and I say sampling because sampling's happened forever, but there's one of the comments about this album is that these samples don't sing without what Moby does to it. And I say that because, you know, you suddenly have, at the time, rock is becoming what it is or whatever it's going to be. And then you've got this album come through and you've got these samples on it. And it just, I think for the listener, the mainstream ear, it suddenly convinced you that, which, you know, either music can be commercial and commercials can be music, because suddenly everyone's looking up, as you said, the car commercial. What was that song? Yep. Oh, it's Porcelain or Southside. Right. Oh my God. Southside was on like everything.
Especially when they added Gwen Stefani to the mix. That just that was the biggest pop single from that album.
Actually. Right. And so, I mean, it just, I think there's something there about what the, you know, American ear, we'll call it, was ready for. And I think this album really hits it. It was ready to take that next leap into whatever it is, whether it's the death of rock and the birth of pop electronica music or just this album. But with that, we always do this because I think it's really easy when you hear about, you know, a bunch of people talking about an album, maybe you know it, maybe you don't, but I'm always curious to know what people pull from it, because I definitely pull certain things from this record. Let's start with our favorite song, and Ben, I'll turn to you. You're our resident DJ on the show. What is the song that you pull out that you were like, this is the one that if I'm playing it, I need people to hear it because it's so good?
For me, it's track 11. You got to get through the album a little bit. You got to get past that first three trifecta. But Run On, for me, that is my favorite. And it's because that piano, that There's the two layers of piano. So there's the piano intro, and then you get that second layer of piano on top, and it's just so good. And it really starts looping.
And then it starts building,
and it just brings in a lot of that, that kind of gospel kind of rootsy, you know, folk flavor into it as well. And I thought that was just it's the best for me. It's the best example of what this album can be.
Yep.
It can be something so simple, just like a couple, like, it sounds like I could play those piano chords. Like, you know, I mean, speaking back to Bush, like one of the first and only songs I could ever play on a guitar, Bush Glycerine. We would have competitions with my complete novice roommates in college to see who could play it the best. But, you know, it's something that its simplicity is what makes it great, I think, especially at the start of that song. But as it builds, it just becomes more and more Moby, and it just takes it to a place that, you know, is so well defined by just this one person.
You know, and I think it's that simplicity and that repetition that's perfectly embodied in the song that a lot of people have a problem with electronica, because they think, oh, it's just the same looped beats over and over again. Then they throw in a sample and that repeats over and over again. It's very repetitive. And yes, some of the music is that repetitive, but this is an example of where it's done, and it's done so well. And it just draws you in because he layers everything. You know, he starts with the piano, and then he starts with the strings, and then he brings in the vocal, and then he loops everything together. And it's awesome. That's a great pick.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You mentioned that you know, the comment that people would think music is, you know, it's repetitive, it's boring, it's whatever. And I almost want to like stop and be like, what do you think we're doing here with music? Like it is a bit of hypnotism. Like that to me, there's some drone rock stuff that I'll listen to. Like, there's a Deer Hunter track to this day I'll listen to just because it gets to the drone part, like a 5-minute solo that I'm just like, yeah, I'm in, I'm locked in. And I was just like, that's what the appeal of a lot of electronic music is that it gets that, and you can kind of turn off your front brain and stop thinking so much and just focus and feel what, you know, the music to Ben describes soaks into you. Like that's what makes music powerful, I think. And certainly with this album.
Yo, how can I not get you into King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard then?
You know, I know you've worked. I'm not into them. It's here's the problem. And Chris, we're all music snobs. I know we are. We're all the resident music snobs in our world. Tell me if you feel this, because I have people that tell me you would love this.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And my brain is just like got a guy with a headset and a clipboard, a big bouncer. And he's like, I don't think you're all getting in tonight. Just you and you, but not you. And like, I have a hard time when something's suggested. And I have listened to a couple of records back. This is one of the great things about music and Spotify and streaming and algorithms. Something came up and I checked it out. And I'm like, I think I should like this. There's a bunch of skate kids from Australia who truly don't give a shit about anything, and they just write these psychedelic space rock songs, and I don't dislike it, but I just don't have the bandwidth yet. And Ben, that is your jam, right?
I'm into that right now.
What's the name of
King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard? They put out about 5 or so albums a year, I think.
Wow.
They're prolific, but are they
like 2-minute songs, like real quick, like 2-minute songs?
No, they're like, it's like I don't know how to even describe it. It's like Fish or something, you know, like a jam band like that, but more intense. It's almost like it's a little bit of metal to it. And they have just all sorts of very experimental, kind of psychedelic.
I would say is the Pitchfork. Yeah, this is the Pitchfork effect. Because I will look up stuff. Like I was checking, there was a band called Perpetual Groove that came up.
That sounds jammy.
Super jammy. Savannah, Georgia. Yeah. And I looked them up and I'm like, does anybody else know about this? Because I don't have the energy to be like, I'm into that band from some city down south that no one else. I used to have that. I don't have that anymore. I need to be able to reference point. King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, I would say, is just about on everybody's like up and coming relevance. You know, like I said, skate rock is what I describe it as. These kids are like skate punks from, I think it's Melbourne or something. So yeah, definitely check them out. But it's a psychedelic trip for sure.
I'll give them a listen for sure. Thanks.
So maybe rock's not dead. maybe that's what that means.
No, it's still there. It's still there. You gotta look for it a little harder though, I think.
Sometimes. You gotta find it for sure. Chris, your favorite track on the album, and you have to pick one.
I think my favorite track, you know, is Natural Blues, track number 8. Yeah. It's so good, and it embodies the album. And I remember back in, it was 99 or 2000, Moby played the MTV Music Awards, and he performed this song, and with the Blue Man Group behind him on percussion, and Jill Scott singing the vocals, singing the gospel chorus, you know, from this song. And it was fantastic. You can find it on YouTube. It's all out there, but it was so good, and I just have that visual memory tied to this song, and it's just, it takes me back every time.
Ooh, Larry.
Yeah, I was gonna say Jill Scott and you know, I mean, the Blue Man Group, like, that is, I mean, that hits.
It was
all
wild.
The parts.
It was crazy. It was so good. And I if I remember correctly, Moby was playing guitar, you know, there as well, and it was like, it was cool, and it was unlike anything in that show. So
we always wonder if there's an echo effect, like somebody has the same thought same way. And that this was actually Hannah's and my favorite, because Hannah, she couldn't appear tonight, and she's in love with this album. She's like, I remember listening to this in high school, loving this album. That song was hers as well, and it was mine as well. I mean, it was hard to go through and not have your ears perk and say, gosh, there's a lot of stuff that I recall.
The entire first half of the album is outstanding. And the last half of the album kind of goes atmospheric. It goes a little ambient, you know, goes instrumental, which is still great. But, you know, for me, those vocal tracks are outstanding.
What do you guys think? Is it? I always wonder about this, and I know it's true. I know there's something to it. But, you know, to that point, I felt the same way, that the A side is much stronger than, you know, the B side of this record, the first half. Just in terms of my tastes, but when they do track listings, you know, there's a choice that goes in. Like, if you look back at some of the great records, there's gotta be some science that would say, if it's track number 3, it's always going to be a single, or if it's track, it's never going to be track 12. That's going to be the single. And in this case, I think there actually was like a track 9 that was a single, but like, is that a thing, or is that just me imagining it's a thing?
You might be imagining it, but one of the games I like playing is like the albums that have the best 1-2 punch, the 1-2 opening punch. So it's tracks 1 and 2 that just kick off the album that just are awesome. And the rest of the album can be whatever, but it's those first 2 tracks that draw you in and grab you. And there's been some albums, you know, in my history anyway, that have had that 1-2 punch that I just.
What's one of them?
Cheap Trick Live at Budokan. The first 2 tracks are just, they draw you in. I want you to want me, and I think it goes into Surrender after that, but it's so good. And then Fountains of Wayne, Welcome Interstate Managers, the first 3 tracks on that just boom boom boom, and then I'm sold for the rest of the album.
Wow. I before we move on, I want to unpack that. You mean to tell me that some producer isn't sitting there saying,
oh, they are. It's planned.
Track 1 has to be this. And track, I mean, right, Ben?
There's a science to it. There's got to be a science to it.
It's got
to
be.
Yeah.
It's got to be. I wish we had like a device that could help us figure that out.
There's a formula. You know, just like there's a formula to any good pop song, I got to believe there's a formula for, you know, record production, you know, for track listings.
There has to be. Has to be. Well, we'll put a pin in that, and maybe our listeners will help us figure that one out. Let's move on here. Let's talk about favorite moment. And favorite moment is important, I think, because not every album has them that are different than the favorite song. But this is one that definitely has a favorite moment. And I'll tell you, you know, my favorite song was the same as yours, Chris. But the favorite moment for me was easy. It's the first 20 seconds of the album, that little, when that it's a keyboard or piano that just comes in. Yeah. And I absolutely, when pianos or keyboards come in percussive, I absolutely always love that. They're not a fill. They're just percussive on the song. And I love that. For me, it's really easy. Track 1, Honey, the first 20 seconds, I'm like, whatever this is, I'm hooked. So Chris, what's your favorite moment on the album?
My favorite moment on the album would probably be the opening strings on Porcelain. As soon as that starts, I'm sucked in. I like almost physically, it's pulling me towards the music with those strings. And yeah.
What's difficult with that song and that this album, perhaps in particular, is to your point earlier about how this album was used and licensed everywhere, is that I have images when I hear Porcelain.
Yep.
And I hope it's not for like a Honda Accord or something. Like in my head, I'm like, I picture an ocean and a windswept dawn. And I'm like, I think that might have been Toyota Camry.
That might have been some car commercial.
2000, but it worked because it's in my brain.
I just remember
I have
some
a sudden urge to have an Amex card.
I remember some show. It was like the series finale or something like that. One Tree Hill or, you know, whatever the, you know, show from that time period. And it was the series finale and they played the Porcelain. This is goodbye. You know, yeah. over the promo. And I was like, well, yeah, that's just
there. Genius. That's the end of it for me. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
Ben, your favorite moment on the record.
So I've talked about this before that any music lover should get themselves a pair of at least halfway decent headphones and possibly even a subscription to, I'm going to do a plug here for Apple Music. So Apple, if you want to, you know, kick something my way, toss me one of those new VR headsets or something.
Meta.
Yeah. Possibly get yourself an Apple Music subscription. Cause a lot of their stuff is in lossless format. So it's really high quality.
Yeah.
But, get those headphones, halfway decent headphones, or even better, good headphones, put them on and listen to If Things Were Perfect. And you'll notice in like the first, I don't know, it's about 10 seconds or so, you can hear like this distinct like paper shuffle. It's a page turn. And it has, I think, a lot of meaning for this album, the title of the song, If Things Were Perfect. And here we have like clearly a page turn. It, you know, it just sounds out of place. It's not musical. It's like a page turn. But I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet. So I don't know if either of you have, but there's a documentary that came out in 2021 called Moby Doc.
Yeah.
And it's on Hulu. I haven't gotten a chance to watch it. I watched the trailer and I was like, I have to watch this, but I didn't get time before we had this episode. But It sounds like after Moby like hit it big with the song that you mentioned, Go, he got a bunch of money and kind of went wild and was big into drugs and he was an alcoholic. And
you should read his autobiography. He's got an autobiography called Porcelain and then a follow up to that called And Everything Falls Apart, where he goes into great detail about his success, his failures, his drug abuse and his like road to recovery.
Wow.
It's pretty good. It's a little name droppy in moments, but I mean, if I was having dinner with, you know, Lou Reed and David Bowie in the same night, I'd be name dropping too.
right.
it's a good read. And he goes into some detail about the production of like this album in particular, about kind of what he did and his thought process about some of the compositions. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So it gets back to our John Doe conversation about, you know, in the moment, if that was intentional, if like he put in a paper shuffle sound that he like grabbed from somewhere, like sampled it, you know what I mean? Or if it's just like, that was just a natural thing that, you know, during recording, he's paging through and he's like, I kind of like it in there. Let's leave it. So I don't know. I just thought, and then, you know, in all the context of some of the struggles that he's had in his life, you know, I just thought, you know, this is cool. Like a song called If Things Were Perfect, and it's definitely not perfect. It's got this paper shuffle in it. So I just, that got me spinning a little bit and just kind of thinking, and I like that a lot.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it when music can, you know, give you that perspective or you know, make you think you have a new perspective on something, or maybe you've discovered something that no one else has heard. It gives you that sense of ownership of the song somewhat.
Right.
And I love that.
Well, I love it. I also love when music gets Ben spinning, because that's one of the things Ben does best here on the Real Wolf Record Club, is he spins. Ben, you love to put things on a playlist. Moby Play, put it on a playlist.
Yes, Joe, I'm going to put this on a playlist, but as always, I'm going to give you a little bit of cutting room floor. Yes,
you got to work with me on this, Chris. It's a little riddle he likes to do.
So okay. I will get to our playlist riddle here, but I'm gonna give you one of my cutting room in a couple parts to this. The Cutting Room playlist was called Songs That Jess Likes. It's a little bit of a deep cut reference for a Dave Matthews Band song called Song That Jane Likes. And because this is actually an album that my wife really loves. She likes this album a lot. She doesn't like a lot of music. I asked her what her favorite songs were because I was going to make a playlist that were songs that Jess likes. And she's like, I don't know. I don't have favorite songs. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to make a very good album out of this. But I did make a playlist that was called Pregnart. It was a pregnancy playlist that I had playing during her first and second delivery in the delivery room. And it was just nice, kind of ambient electronica, a lot music. And it had a lot of Moby on it. And I actually had a couple nurses give me compliments, said, this is really good. Where'd you get this? And I said, I made it.
Nice.
Playlist. So songs that Jess likes, we could put a lot from the Moby album play on that, but that's not what I did. But I did put a Moby song on the playlist, the real playlist here. And I put on Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad? I also put on there Phil Collins, Take Me Home. Next is Peter Gabriel, Digging in the Dirt. Great tune. The Smashing Pumpkins, Perfect.
Ah.
Pitbull, Mr. Worldwide himself, Time of Our Lives.
Okay.
And then the final song that I'm going to say, and more songs as always, the sixth song in this playlist is Seal, Kiss from a Rose. Joe, what is the theme of this playlist? Chris, you got this one?
Date night?
It is not date night.
Kiss from a Rose. Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad?
Nope.
What was the Pitbull track again?
Pitbull track is Time of Our Lives. It's Mr. Worldwide.
This is your date night. This is married date night.
What this is. What this
emotion?
Is.
It's emotion. It's. Go ahead.
It is No Hair, Don't Care. Bald is Beautiful. This is for all the bald dudes out there. You can make it too. You can make it too. You don't have to be a podcaster. You can be a musical rock star.
All right.
That's fantastic.
So these are all guys, these are all lead singers or artists who are bald.
We're bald.
Prominently featured on the cover of Play is a bald Moby and
of course, a
dog, if I remember correctly. I would also recommend looking at the Phil Collins album for Take Me Home, which also has a very menacing and bald Phil Collins on the cover.
A great one.
It is a menacing Phil. Look at this album. Look at this album and tell me, Phil Collins, No Jacket Required. Tell me that Phil Collins is not a menacing person.
Menacing, huh?
If it's the one I'm thinking of, yeah, I could see that.
It's kind of a red-orange-tinged Phil Collins staring past your soul. He's staring so far through it. It's like through your soul.
Well, Ben, you have not disappointed. I like Bald Rights Unite. I love that. pour one out for all your bald friends there.
proud member of the club here.
Yeah. Well, as always, you can check out all of Ben's playlists. You can go to our website, realwolfrecordclub.com. There's episode information. There's guest information. You can get information on the playlist. You can even buy merch from our very good friend, Ward Sutton. You can also find information on Spotify and Apple. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll be able to find Ben's playlist as well. So, I mean, as we wrap up our discussion of this record, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that it's, I use the phrase ubiquitous. It was everywhere for a period of time that a lot of us are going to walk away with, whether it's some sort of visual a la My Daughter visual you saw that you remembered the song that hooked in your brain. And then you later figured out that was Moby, or you knew it was Moby because you were in on the ground floor with an album like Animal Rights and waiting for that next thing to come out. And here it was. It's an album that was kind of everywhere. And to your point, Chris, Moby, as he tells his story in his biography or documentary or whatever it is, he was kind of everywhere for a long time with a lot of people. What's the legacy of this album for a listener who's gonna know Moby, but maybe has overlooked it because he is so everywhere? What's the legacy of this album?
I think the legacy of this album is it kind of redefined what electronica could be. it made it more accessible to people. So people, it's people just can listen to it more, you know. So it's they know about electronica more because of this album, and they're more accepting of electronica because of this album. That being said, electronica still hasn't really broken in the States, you know, right. not to the degree that I would like to see it, but it is at least understood maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the thing. I had experience. If I knew it, I thought Moby was Fatboy Slim, apparently. But I knew some of the stuff. And when I listened, I'm like, oh, I definitely know this. And then I went through and I'm like, oh my God. When I hit Southside, I was like, where's Gwen Stefani? That's how much I knew, because that song was everywhere. And so I think you're hitting it exactly, that this was that album that, even if it never stayed as a genre, it really was a pop sensation. That's really the only way to call it. I think I read that on Wikipedia, but I mean, it was really an album that really hit high notes just about everywhere.
It sold over 12 million copies. I mean, it's huge.
And that's I'm going to ask you, is that a lot?
That's a lot. that's a lot. It's probably sold more since, you know, 2010 or whenever that stat came out. But that's quite a bit, considering it started so small and they were only anticipating 250,000 sold.
Well, and we say that truthfully, because we talked about a Pearl Jam record and trying to compare how many streams it has versus how many records sold. And there is a calculation you can do, but I know that because one of the Moby top tracks on Spotify has like 242 million streams. That equates to a lot of plays. That's a lot of records. So,
for sure.
So yeah. So Ben, we'll start with you. What is your ranking of this album? Bury It, Borrow It, Buy It, or Buy It Again?
You know, you talked about this album hitting almost everywhere, and the almost part of that was Pitchfork. And the last line in the quote of the a Pitchfork review is, in short, it's fun and functional yet disposable. Play is the condom of rock.
Clutching the pearls over here.
Yeah,
like,
they gave
my
it
goodness.
5 out of 10.
Ooh,
a great review.
The condom of rock.
The condom of rock. Yeah, he kind of.
I don't even know what that.
He kind of says that movie. It's just like all very samey ambient. Like the back half is all the same, and it's for the hardcore scene, like the Connecticut hardcore kid. So like, you know, for the affluent, like I couldn't disagree more. And you know, you look back on it, this album has certainly grown some legs and traveled. Yeah. You know, 'cause this was right when the album came out, June 1st, 1999, the review, but I couldn't disagree more with that take. Because I think this is an album that does something very special. And I think both of you guys kind of hit on this, but it takes something that maybe wasn't very accessible to a lot of people and made it very accessible and very enjoyable, and something that a lot of people could relate to, you know, together. It's like it's music that brings people together. You know, you talked about pop music doing that. And you know, having that function, people really like it a lot. You know, this did that as well for people that didn't have a lot of experience with electronic music, that maybe didn't get into that genre at all.
Yeah.
And this just made it's like, yeah, but electronic music can sound like the blues. It can sound like gospel. It can sound Southern. Like those aren't things that I would expect to describe, you know, electronic music. I would have said like it sounds like acid, or it sounds like glow stick, you know, it's like whatever. Yeah. You know, but this album does that, and so for me, I think just its importance, how much I enjoy it in the experience of listening to it, makes it a super solid buy it for me. I'll maybe have to buy it and then buy it again, give a copy to my wife. So I'm right on the fence. I'm right on the line.
Ah, love it. Well, and you guys, again, I'm outnumbered here by DJs, and I've told you already, I didn't have a ton of familiarity with electronica music, and I never went back, because I think my path in music went quickly from hardcore punk to metal to indie rap to indie rock to, I still dabble in all of those things, to all the way back to the blues and, you know, Rolling Stones and things like that. And it's not that I was against it. It's not that my ears were turned off to it. I just never spent the time with it. And so for me, it's an album that I enjoyed. It's got a lot of stuff that's, I would say, nostalgic for me, stuff that I remember. I had a friend in high school. She loved this CD and we'd listen to it every day on the ride to school. We'd hear it all the time. And yep. So for me, it's comforting. It's nostalgic. It's one that I'm on the border between borrow it and buy it. It's a great album. I think you should absolutely check it out. But that's kind of where I fell in a lot of that. That's, you know, as we do with any, it's more about me than it is about the album. It's kind of where your ears are at. But Chris, you get to send us home. What do you take away? What's your love of this album? Bury it, borrow it, buy it, or buy it again?
Well, I definitely have the nostalgia factor, you know, for this album. I loved it when it came out. My wife and I both kind of discovered it together and we fell in love with it. And it's also one of those albums, and this is a litmus test for me, is when you put on an album and you listen to it and you're walking away from the record player, the CD player, the streamer, or whatever, and the song comes on and you actually turn around and you look at the record player or you look at the stereo, like, what did I just hear? This was that album for me. You know, one of those few albums that does that for me, where I was like, wow, what am I hearing? And did I actually play that? And so for that, it makes it a buy it again for me.
Oh, love it. Yeah.
When I wear this out, I will buy another one.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It's an album that I don't know that there's a bad way to talk badly about it. How about that? There's so much to do with it, whether it's nostalgia or whether it's the appeal of something that you might not have access to, or whether it's the hooks and the samples that he does so well with the rhythm and the beat that he puts into it and the timing and all those things that go in. But definitely worth checking out is Moby Play, but also worth checking out is our good friend Chris Brooker and his project right now, the Brooker Family Popcast. You can find them. I just checked. You can Google them and find their website. Yeah. That'll give you all the info you need.
Check them out.
Yeah, exactly.
We're real, everybody.
They're real. Check them out. Like I said, we already kind of touched on it. A lot of music, pop culture. They talk about the freaking Rugrats. Come on, man.
Yeah.
I could talk Rugrats all day. Nicktoons for life. But definitely check them out. Support them wherever you get your podcasts. It's the Brooker Family Popcast. And this is the Real Wolf Record Club podcast. You can check us out at realwolfrecordclub.com. And follow us on Instagram at Real Wolf Record Club and definitely join in the conversation. Hopefully you're following along, checking out these albums, because if you're doing nothing else, listening music is a great way to pass the time. So this is the Real Wolf Record Club.
This has been the Real Wolf Record Club podcast, a production of Real Wolf Productions, LLC, a limited liability company. This show is produced by Ben Head and hosted by Joe Vantomi, with musical credits to the incomparable Laserbeak. Follow us and join the club on Instagram at Real Wolf Record Club or on Twitter at Real Wolf RC. Check out our website at realwolfrecordclub.com to find all our episodes, guest information, playlists, and merch created by Ward Sutton.